Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled Blackness and Postcoloniality in Korean Literature and Culture. Our speaker is Dr. Ji Hyun Ahn from the Department of English Literature at Seoul National University. We begin with an introduction by African American Studies Program Director, Dr. Linda Haywood.
Today, we are really very pleased to welcome Dr. Ji Hyun Ahn, who is Associate Professor of English Literature at Seoul National University. Dr. Ji Hyun grew up in Seoul and New Jersey and received her BA and MA in English Literature from Seoul National University and her PhD from the University of Chicago in 2003. Her interests center on African-American literature, feminist theory, ethnic studies, and cultural studies. She's currently residing in Boston as a Harvard Yenchin Visiting Scholar, working on a project that focuses on the representation of African-Americans in Korean literature after the Korean War. Her other ongoing works include the examination of the relationship between Black thought and American exceptionalism, with a focus on W.E.B. Du Bois's writings, and also a study on the postcoloniality of Korean American literature and Korean literature in the context of transnational Asian American studies. In that context, today, Dr. Ji Hyun Ahn will speak, and her topic is Blackness and Postcoloniality in Korean Literature and Culture. Thank you very much, and welcome, Dr. Ji Hyun.
It's a great pleasure and an honor to be able to have this opportunity to speak to you today. I'd like to thank the program and Dr. Haywood for inviting me, and thank all of you for coming to this rather strange topic that I don't think it's a conventional topic for African American Studies program. And it's actually part of Korean studies if you really want to categorize it in strictly academic terms. So I think I should probably start by talking a little bit about how I happened to arrive at this topic. And I don't think I would have imagined that I would be writing about this 10 years ago when I was a graduate student in Chicago. As you know, as Dr. Haywood introduced me, I'm an African-Americanist by training. And I don't think I ever actually wrote a scholarly paper on Korean literature because I'm not a scholar trained in that field. But having grown up in both Korea and in the U.S., I've always been really sensitive to issues of race, perhaps because, moving around in different geographical locations, I've always been, in my personal life, when I was a child and growing up, I've always been confronted with racial issues or very uncomfortable situations throughout my childhood, both in Korea and the U.S. So I'd like to begin my talk today by sharing one of these experiences with you. And I think this experience has remained with me all along, lodged deep in some corners of my mind, I think until very recently, and gave shape to this particular topic that I would like to share with you today. So is a Korean word, and it's the N-word in Korean. So I don't want to use this word because it is a very offensive word, but it is a word that is very prevalent in Korean culture, even nowadays. So, and it's a term that was very widely in use when I was growing up in Seoul during the 1970s and 1980s. And it has other Koreans. I've witnessed racist slurs such as another Korean word is which means broket, and it's like sort of black, round, coal-like fuel that we used a lot in Seoul when I was growing up in the houses. So I've witnessed these kind of slurs hurled at blacks behind their backs by Koreans, especially in the Itaewon area. I don't know how many of you have been to Korea. It's a very popular area, populated by many expats, especially by Americans and American GIs. And also, blackface comedies enjoyed immense popularity on TV shows during the 1970s and 80s when I was growing up. So I would always be exposed to these kinds of things when I was growing up. So one could easily come across these kind of blackface comedians if you watch TV, caricaturing blacks as dumb, gross, and subhuman on TV. In fact, blackface has been a consistent feature of Korean popular culture since the 1970s, and although not quite as common nowadays, comedians in blackface still make appearances on TV in the very same tradition. So blackface is also used to visually show performing authentic black voices, as in the recent instance of this group called Bubble Sisters. They were quite popular in Korea. There's another group called Big Mama, but I think they sort of disbanded recently due to their lack of success. So one may suggest that in the case of Bubble Sisters, their racial desire in mimicking the authenticity of black voices is what propels their black faces, not any malicious intention of demeaning blacks. But nevertheless, I would argue that their utter lack of self-consciousness in putting on blackface precisely demonstrates the kind of problematic nature of racist representations of blacks in Korean culture. So I just wanted to give you a sense of how prevalent this kind of thing is in Korea. It's very offensive, but it hardly goes remarked by anybody, any cultural critics in Korea, which is really kind of really surprising. These examples of racial slurs and demeaning blackface caricatures in Korean culture coexist with white identifications and resistance to identify with black characters. So I had this experience a long time ago when I was growing up, and I was exposed to this kind of culture even when I went back to Korea. But what really gave impetus to this project was it's actually my teaching experience since going back to my alma mater after graduating. So my project grew out of my concerns and puzzlement over why it is that an overwhelming number of Korean students that I've been teaching at a very prestigious university, who should also be very attuned to PC, but they're not really, have trouble identifying or empathizing with black characters in literary texts. So if I were teaching The Bluest Eye or Invisible Man, any novel or any even visual texts or movies, in my teaching experience, the biggest obstacle in teaching these materials was to get the students to recognize the humanity of these characters. And I was so surprised to find out that many Korean students came to the classroom with a prejudice and in some cases very deeply racist attitude that blacks are inferior, lazy, violent, and subhuman. So when I was teaching as a graduate student in Chicago, students would never say something that's blatantly racist in classrooms, right? Because they're all very smart and they're all PC. But in Korea, they would just say these things and I would be so shocked, and I would actually find myself in the same kind of situation over the 6 years that I've been teaching at my college. So it was at this point that some fundamental questions arose. Why do most Koreans show extreme resistance to identifying with black characters? What does blackness invoke in Koreans? How have Korean culture and literature represented blacks and blackness? What do these representations tell us about how Koreans mediate their own subjectivity in the imagined racial hierarchy? So I like to begin my paper and first talk about a little bit about Korean history and social history so that you get a sense of what it's like. So historically, race has the most curious face in contemporary Korean society, and it's been like that all along after our modernization started, I think. So under the shrouded mythic articulation of a homogenous nation or of one blood, the hegemonic institutions and the dominant cultural discourse have interpolated Koreans into sanctifying their ethnic purity and in turn degrading the other, as can be seen in any number of derogatory terms for designating the other, such as daenom, which is Chinese, jokpari, which is Japanese, and gamdungi, which is the N-word in Korean. The most pervasive form of justification that can be heard in defense of these offensive terms for Koreans is that Koreans have suffered horrific foreign invasions throughout its long history, which is all true, while having remained a peace-loving people without war-mongering intentions on other peoples or nations. I'm not sure about that part. And that whilst, because you can always justify, what you have done in retrospect. And that whilst these terms may shamefully be derogatory, nevertheless, ruefully reflect the long-standing victimhood of the nation's various traumatic historical experiences. Regardless of the veracity of this claim, what remains true is that these terms very much remain deep-rooted in the fabric of Korean society today, reinforcing the belief that Koreans are of one blood. Now, I would like to make it very clear here that I'm not suggesting that Koreans are particularly more racist than other nationalities, or that racism is somehow native to Korean culture and historical experiences, that they're sort of born with this kind of racism. That's not what I'm talking about. So what I do want to point out before I start analyzing the text today is that there are, of course, several historically significant external factors which had a huge influence on the shaping of the racist attitudes of Koreans. The first one, most scholars actually point out that it's Japanese colonialism, because as you probably all know, Korea was colonized by Japan from 1919, for a long time, 1945. And during this period, Korea was not modernized before the colonization of by Japan. So Japan underwent modernization first, and during that time, if you look at the Japanese culture, there are a lot of offensive racist imageries that circulated during that time. Like, you can see like images of Sambo all over the popular culture if you look at the magazines or other forms of popular culture. So Korean intellectuals who actually went to Japan to study, they were influenced by this kind of racist attitude and brought that back to Korea. And the other factor that many scholars point to is, of course, the Korean War. The racist attitudes of Koreans were in large part also shaped by the racial dynamics within the U.S. Army, which had segregated facilities. And the thing that emerges in the military camp town literature is that you can't share your whores. You have your prostitutes who only provide service for white soldiers. And once you debase yourself by servicing black soldiers, you can't go back to the white soldiers, because that's how it worked. So so there's a lot of learned racism that came from the experience of Korean War. So that's one thing that I wanted to point out. And the other thing that I wanted to clarify before we begin is the term post-colonial. I know that it's used for probably all kinds of things these days. And for Korean history, it's more problematic because, as you know, we were colonized by Japan, so we experienced Japanese colonialism. So I'm just going to go briefly over the history of Korean War. So after colonization, Korea was liberated and the country was divided. And we had the Korean War. And as you know, it was one of the most devastating wars of the last century. More bombs were dropped during the 3 years in all of Europe during World War II. More napalm used than during the more than the two decades long Vietnam War. The total casualties was estimated 5 million, and out of that number, 3 million were Koreans, which was 10% of the population. And 10 million families were separated from their family members, so practically every South Korean that I know has some family member in the North. So harsh autocratic regimes reigned for decades in both Koreas. So anyway, so here, as you can see, Korea has never been, you know, territorially colonized by the U.S. We speak Korean. We have our own sovereign government. So I'm not saying that it was colonized. So when I say post-colonial, it's not post-colonial from the U.S. being colonized territorially, right? So the complexity of determining what post means when I say post-coloniality in Korean literature, and specifically in military camp town literature, is that, of course, it's post to Japanese colonialism. So when does post begin? Isn't Korea also, you know, some scholars argue that Korea is also a colonizing force in the third world, buying land, you know, all of these multinational companies buying land in poor countries nowadays, which is true. And I would like to say that yes to all of these questions. I use the term post to specify after the liberation from Japanese colonialism, but also the ongoing colonialism in the form of U.S. neocolonialism, even if Korea is also part of that neocolonial institution that's oppressing other third world countries. I think it's all happening at the same time. So going back to the Korean War, U.S. intervention, or some leftist scholars call it occupation, depending on your perspective, in the Korean War is considered by many scholars as neo-colonialist and wielding influence in political, economic, social, and cultural spheres without actual territorial colonization of Korea. Especially problematic is the extension of U.S. dominance in the Korean Peninsula in the form of the often forgotten U.S. military occupation. Again, some people call it U.S. existence. You know, the army is here to help Korea against North Korea. under the guise of benevolent protection in the physically, material, and symbolic form of military camp towns. So as you can see, military camp towns are it's sort of a community that caters to the needs of the U.S. Army that always coheres around the Army base. And prostitution is a major economy in that sort of society. And as of 2004, there were 72 camp towns all over South Korea. So when I say Gijichon, that's military camp town, and that's a genre that I'll be dealing with. So anyway, as Lisa Low points out in her famous book, Immigrant Acts, quote, the wars in Korea and Vietnam were as much a stage for the ideological lesson that the U.S. could and should determine how capital could move globally as the wars also secured the material conditions for that movement. The wars of the 1950s to the 1970s laid the groundwork for the U.S. investment and material extraction in Asia that took place only later in the 1980s, with global restructuring, displacing Korean and Vietnamese populations, some of which have immigrated to the U.S. So Lisa Low, via Bruce Cummings, of course, sees Korean War as an imperial war. So I would like to, I wanted to just talk about that a little bit. So this is the context that I'm working from. So in this context, my interest in examining the implication of blackness in Korean military camp town literature, which is called Gijichon in Korean, is an also attempt to bridge the discourses among American studies, African-American studies, and Korean studies through the prism of race and its role in the shape of our lived experiences of post-coloniality today. So now I think I would turn to the text that I want to share with you today. And because none of these texts are translated into English, I had to do all the translation, so it's all my translation. And because you're not familiar with these stories, I just brought some passages that so that you can look at them. But they're really offensive passages. And when I was working on this paper, I was actually literally sick every day because it was just very overwhelmingly offensive to me. So I just wanted to warn you before you go into those stories. So let me just get into the military camp town literature. So this is the subgenre of Korean literature, and it's not really popular in Korea. It's not really widely read because, first of all, as I said, Korean War is sort of a forgotten war in Korea. We all, you know, we don't talk about it. We talk about the future, you know, how do we get into top 10 countries in the world? So people don't really talk about the Korean War, and especially the Gijichon literature, military camp town literature, is not a popular genre, but it's mostly studied by the scholars. So as I said before, Korean War was the first instance in modern Korean history during which Koreans came into an extended contact with Americans and especially African Americans, and also American culture. Not only did the existence of Gijichon, military camp town, stir the imagination of Korean writers during and after the war, but this is what's really interesting. But long after the war ended, when a prolonged U.S. military occupation in Korea also continued to give impulse to represent Gijichon experience. So we have these stories dealing with military camp towns even up to the 1990s and some even in 21st century. So it's sort of embedded in the unconsciousness of Korea that we try to forget the war and the existence of the American army camps in Korea. But I think it's really intricately interrelated to the economic system of Korea, and also the political, of course, the political situation, which is always tenuous, right? So that's what's interesting about this particular genre, that it's just ongoing, and many writers are still grappling with this experience. So as such, blackness in the imagination of Koreans has its initial roots in the strange encounter between Koreans and black American GIs in and around Gijichon, military camp town. There's a long list of works under this subgenre, but for the purpose of this particular study, I have chosen texts in which African Americans or Koreans of African American descent are given more prominence than other Gijichon literary works. So I'm just going to be talking about three stories. My paper actually deals with a lot more, but I just cut it down to three stories. The first one was published in 1957, so it's a very early form of military camp town literature, and it's called Shorty Kim. because Koreans are shorter than Americans, he was called Shorty by the American GIs, in the title of the story. And the next story is published by Cho Hae-il, and it's entitled America, and that was published in 1972. And the last story is entitled The Sea Wall, 해벽, which was published in 1974. It's actually, there are no translations, but if you go through the text, it's really obvious that even from a cursory reading, that writers themselves and the characters within the story are not very aware of the racist depictions and portrayals of blackness. However, my purpose is not to point out that there's, you know, clear racism embedded in these texts, although I would like to bring attention to the fact that the racist depictions of black still go largely unremarked in literary criticism on Korean literature. My main contention is that the brutal nature of blackness invoking deep fear and shame in the protagonists of these literary works operates to signal a heightened fear of U.S. imperialism and a profound sense of national shame. So the word shame in Korean is 수치심, and that word is just all over the text. Any stories that you read, it's always a shame, shame, shame that our land is trampled by the U.S. Moreover, the text's curious obsession with black bodies and the compulsive, I mean, that's the only way that I could actually see it. It's very compulsive. Bestialization of blacks reveal an attempted hierarchization of Koreans above blacks with an underlying belief in white supremacy and coming to terms with their post-colonial subjectivity. So that's sort of my main argument that I'll try to make. The repulsively demeaning images of blacks show assumptions of superiority towards blacks and also an attempt on the part of the colonized, meaning Koreans here, to invert the power dynamics inherent in the U.S.-Korea relations as manifested in the physical and spatial occupation of Gijichun. What emerges then is a racialized post-colonial subjectivity negotiated in these textual representations and accordingly a paradoxical rendering of the prefix post of being firmly resistant to the U.S. as an occupational force threatening national sovereignty while at the same time acknowledging white supremacy legitimating the U.S. presence in the Korean Peninsula. So I see these writers also very complicit in that kind of legitimization of, you know, the U.S., although what they're trying to do is resist U.S. imperialism. So it's very ironic. I was at a Mellis conference yesterday and the day before, and I heard Carla Holloway talk, and she actually talked about playing the dark when she was giving her keynote speech, and she said that she was interested in applying Morrison's insight into other ethnic literature, like not white literature, and she's been working on that project, and actually that's what I've been trying to do with my work, which is Toni Morrison, who has eloquently expounded on the significance of Africanist presence in American literature. I don't think I have to talk in detail about her work, but of course her central tenet in this work was that Africanist presence played a surprisingly important role in defining American identity, and that this presence is not marginal but essential to the identity formation of Americans, right? So expanding her insight into the Africanist presence, I would like to ruminate on the significance of blackness in Korean Gijichun literature, military campaign literature, to contemplate on the shape of the post-colonial subjectivity that emerges out of this interesting set of texts. In doing so, I also borrow Baba's observations on the processes of subjectification in a slightly different paradigmics to reflect on the complicated ways in which the colonized use stereotypical and racist images propagated by the colonizer. So what I was trying to get at is that it was so interesting for me that Korean writers were using black bodies to think about their own subjectivity in terms of their relation to the U.S. And as I said, this is sort of the overarching question for all of these writers, that what does America, you know, America mean to us? I came to ask this question, what is America to me? It's sort of like, you know, McKay talking about it or other African-Americans who are always talking about what is America to us, right? But they're trying to think about this question through the body of black soldiers. And I was trying to use Baba's insight by sort of inverting, you know, Koreans who are supposed to be colonized and being subjectified in that kind of position and using the black body to invert their power dynamics. But I think in the end, by sort of consolidating white supremacy, that they subjectify their own position to the whites in the end. So that's the sort of question that I wanted to answer in my paper. And I think I will just get into the text at this point, since I have 30 minutes. And the section that I'll be talking about, I entitled it The Rape of the Nation, Obsession with and the Bestialization of Black Bodies. A famous Korean critic, Yoon-sik Kim, writes, Kang's survey of 1,835 popular stories revealed Black's absence in Korean literature until 1961. So there weren't that many Black characters in Korean literature, but if you include the military camp town literature, it reveals a different statistics. And the story Shorty Kim, which is the first story that I'll be talking about, it was published in the 1950s, right after the Korean War. It's a very short story, and it features a Black character named Bulldog. Of all the names, we don't really know his real name. He's just called Bulldog. So let me just start out with this particular story. The portrayal of Bulldog as one of the first Black characters to appear in Korean literature sets up the dominant imagery of Blacks as inferior animalistic beings. The story revolves around a young boy named Shorty Kim, and he's an orphan boy with a traumatic past whose itinerant life has landed him on a contemporary sting-like living on a U.S. Army base in the provinces. So it's a really story of a young boy, and his entire family was crushed to death, and he had to witness this death, and it was very traumatizing for him. So he's traveling around the country just to, you know, make a living. And what he does is that he mainly pimps off an older girl named Diring Nuna. Nuna in Korean is sister, so he follows her around all the time, and he's sort of a young boy who pimps her off to make a living. So, quote, he says, Yankees have more than enough to eat and wear, so there is more than enough to live on with just their garbage. But I don't just depend on that kind of leftovers. All I need to get is to get one or two soldiers to lust after Diring Nuna. So he's very proud that he's actually working for this, that he doesn't just like, live off the garbage, that he can actually eat. And to have that access to garbage was a big thing after the Korean War, because only people who have connections could actually get the garbage and the ham and the sausages left over from the army camp. We actually still have this dish called, budaejjigae, which is army camp town soup, and it's sort of putting all of the leftovers together as a soup dish. So that's sort of the remnant of the U.S. Army presence. So anyway, the tragedy of the story emanates from the seemingly innocent tone of this protagonist and his pretended naivete, not fully able to understand the meaning of his sordid deeds. Although the boy is a pimp, he is portrayed as an innocent being dreaming in children's rhymes. His utter detachment from the ugly reality is what makes the story poignant. Drinking, gambling, prostitution are all part of the ordinary daily lives of the younger Korean boys who run various errands around the camp. They are also, at oftentimes, exposed to nudity by drunken soldiers and to frequent requests of sexual acts by these same men. But what's interesting is that Shorty Kim never talks about these kind of homosexual advances to younger boys, but he talks about the girls and the women. Interestingly, none of these stories are told in detail except the sexual exchanges between the soldiers and the prostitutes. So here we're interested. I'm not going to read all the passages, so you can just read them. And he's called Gumdungi, which is equivalent of Gumdungi, K-U-M, by Shorty Kim, without any given explanation. So this is really an abrupt introduction. All of a sudden, he talks about this character, Bulldog. And there's no trace of irony in the text. Moreover, Bulldog is compared to a vicious dog and a fat pig. What is interesting about the above passage is that the text makes it very clear that although Koreans may live off of the garbage taken out from the military base, Bulldog is portrayed as less than human, a grade lower than Shorty Kim in this hierarchy of scavengery. So Shorty Kim feels very superior to this character, Bulldog, and he makes fun of him all the time, so he's sort of the butt of his joke. The bestiality of this particular character is further emphasized in a scene where the boy, as matter-of-factly, explains why Bulldog is an unsavory character. In an explicit scene where Shorty Kim reminisces about having watched the sexual copulation of Bulldog and Diri Nuna, as he is wont to do, Shorty recounts the fact that although the girl almost always welcomes all kinds of sexual exchanges with the soldiers, she was almost breathless with disgust as she called out, "God, I'm gonna die," crushed under the weight of the body of this Western pig. After it's over, the girl tells Shorty to never, quote, to never bring back that gamdungi ever again, unquote. The life of Koreans living on this military camp town is less than human itself. Shorty, for instance, has to spar with another Korean boy as sort of a human dogfight, which is reminiscent of the infamous battle royal scene in Ellison's Invisible Man, of course, to amuse the audience of soldiers. And the soldiers can get rid of any Korean bodies without any legal punishment if they happen to end up killing the Korean civilians. In a word, this is a lawless country where all desires and lusts of soldiers are gratified on the bodies of Koreans, as symbolized by the body of the girls are called Yang Galbo, which means Western whore. But even to their painful and absurd existence, the most despised being for Shorty and the girl, Diri Nuna, is Bulldog. Quote, "God, Western sow-like gamdungi bastard, hope the dead ghost strike you dead." So this is the curse that's sort of on Bulldog, and it sort of resonates in the story. So, as I said, the bestialization, in fact, hierarchizes both Shorty and the girl above Bulldog, who sort of paradoxically stands for the aggressor of the U.S. So this is written right after the war, and it's not full-blown kind of anti-American in the way that it deals with the soldiers. So this kind of vague anti-American sentiments turn into a full-blown critique of the U.S. and Cho's America. This is the next story that I want to look at. Published during, I don't know if you know him, President Park Chung-hee, who was this famous dictator who ruled for a long time in Korea, when anti-American sentiments became more reified in the 1950s. The critique of, quote, benevolent, unquote, U.S. becomes more trenchant as the protagonist of the story, his name Hyo-sik, his uncle Riley comments, quote, "Weak people, unfortunate people, people suffering from disasters. Isn't Americans' motto to help people like these? If there's no suffering, they will even invent an excuse," unquote. So Hyo-sik, which is the protagonist, is compared to, if you want to compare him to Shorty, he's sort of a more mature and articulate version of Shorty. So it's usually a male character who's the protagonist. And he's a college dropout, but like Shorty, Hyo-sik has a traumatic past. So again, we have a character who has a very traumatic past. He's also an orphan who lost his entire family when an apartment building collapsed due to shoddy constructions. If Shorty is traumatized victim of the Korean War, Hyo-sik, the protagonist of this story, can be said to be a victim of the massive speed of industrialization and modernization. The story opens in the year of 1969, and Hyo-sik, returning from the military service, opts to drop out of college. Quote, "I have absolutely no intentions of going back inside the walls of that idiotic innocent fiction," unquote. Instead, Hyo-sik chooses to go and live with his uncle, who runs a club at a military camp town called Yalo. So he goes to this place that he's never heard of, and what happens is that first, he's very surprised by this world that he's never seen, and he's never actually met anybody who told him about this kind of world. And he seems very innocent at first, but he quickly moves from innocence to experience as he gradually adjusts to the new life around him by sleeping with as many prostitutes as possible without any guilt. So he's really happy, free-floating, living off his uncle, meeting all these girls, partying all the time. Slowly becoming a hedonistic nihilist and ensconced in this sort of no man's land, isolated from the world, it seems as if Hyo-sik's prolonged state of pleasure-seeking life will continue in a sheltered world. To be sure, in between his pleasure-ridden life, Hyo-sik comes to learn and share with the readers his new realization that the economy of this particular Gijichon, military camp town, is actually what feeds the economy of the entire country and so forth, with implications that what fuels the Korean economy is U.S. capitalism. But something happens that snaps Hushik out of his inertia. As the story is framed by Hushik narrating from the present his past life in a military camp town, Hushik tells the readers that he was gravely mistaken in assuming this life as, quote, innocent, unquote, when a cataclysmic event tears this small town apart. It bears observing that in the enactment of the violent scene where Hushik witnesses close at hand a black soldier violently abusing his mistress, the bestialization of the black soldier as Gamdungi is overshadowed by the hysterical voice fixated on the wildness of the man that he sees. In fact, in the story, the word wild outrage, in Korean it's gwangpo, appears over and over again to the point of being so redundant that the reader is not sure of what to make of this fear and anxiety on the part of the protagonist. So it's almost like he's driven by this fear and he's not sure what to make of this black figure in front of him. To Hyoshik's eyes, the man wielding a dangerous weapon is not a human being. One cannot miss the stereotype images of the grotesque gorilla-like being with white teeth wildly moving in a violent motion. But what is more striking is the palpable fear felt in the part of the narrator I. Contrary to the narrative intentions, it's almost as if what the protagonist is afraid of is not that the wild being will harm the women, but the fact that the protagonist is so immobilized by the unknown fear lurking in his heart. The bestialization of the scene is reinscribed as a chorus of women responding to this incident. So the women, the prostitutes, hear about this terrible thing that happened. And they chant in one voice, quote, my God, how horrendous. All Gamdungi b****s are animals, animals, unquote. From this narrative moment onwards, the black soldier is referred to as not just Gamdungi, but Gamdungi b****. At the same time, the word wild animal appears over and over again, reinforcing the imagery of a mad animal put on loose. To grasp the full import of the above incident, we need to look closely at what ensues the scene. The narrative focuses primarily on not a guilt-ridden intellectual unable to effectively respond to the situation, but the literal emasculation of the protagonist, as the scene dominates his mind as a symbolic of the rape of the nation. When Hushik seeks to assert his manhood by visiting a prostitute, his manhood is once more crushed. So after this happens, he goes to this prostitute that he knows, and he's trying to have sex with this girl. And the text, this is the writer, that's what I'm implying here, sympathetically portrays Hushik's shame in first failing to get an erection and then triumphantly applauds him when he's able to perform after overcoming the immense fear and shame that his nation has been crushed. As one of the critics, Eun-ha Kim, notes, this is evidently a story about the, quote, construction of post-colonial masculine subjectivity, unquote. However, what must be noted is that U.S. domination is represented in a bizarre fashion in the figure of the black soldier as bestial, animalistic, and wild. Even the women's chanting, quote, Gamdungi bastards, unquote, without any trace of irony in the text, relegates blacks to subhuman status. Quote, how dare a Gamdungi bastard presume to act like a husband with just a few dollars, unquote. By positing the wild animal as figuring U.S. domination, but simultaneously hierarchizing the Koreans above blacks, the text crystallizes a new racialized post-colonial subjectivity emerging out of Kijichon experience. So let's move to the last story. And this story is the most horrific out of all the stories that I'll be talking about today. Haebyeok, translated as the seawall, written by Lee Moon-gu during the height of President Park Chung-hee's modernizing project during the 1970s, is perhaps the most shockingly disturbing in its explicit descriptions of bestiality and the brutal gang rape of Korean women. And this is kind of unusual because it involves a woman who's not a prostitute, but she's a civilian, by five black soldiers. In continuum with two previous stories I have analyzed, the story is told in the present as a flashback of the past by an older man, Cho Dong-man, whose father and grandfather were all patriarchs of a small seaside village called Sapogot. So here is this male patriarch who has authority. So he's talking about the demise of this village that he so loved. It's his tale of witnessing the economic demise and moral degradation of his beloved village. This rapid decline of the small village progresses in tandem with the growth of a small U.S. Army base nearby in the midst of rapid industrialization and modernization that's taking place all over the country under the rule of President Park Chung-hee. as the leader of this village, Cho's efforts for reform from ground up are crushed under the massive speed and size of the top-down initiatives of the government. The text implies that it's actually U.S. capitalism that is fueling the industrialization and modernization in Korea, and that Korea is socio-politically subordinated by the U.S. The condemnation of U.S. domination is powerfully voiced in a brutal depiction of the gang rape of a woman, Mr. Hwang's daughter-in-law, by five black soldiers. The sheer violence of this passage is striking, with images of black soldiers literally being turned into animals, quote, animals, in the eyes of the old man, trampling on his daughter-in-law. The patriarchal authority of this old man holds no sway and is utterly powerless against the violence of the soldiers. But one by one, these soldiers are no longer named soldiers, but gamdungi. The shockingly horrifying portrayal of this gang rape is immediately followed by Cho's reminiscence of another incident, an equally horrific story of the debasement of a Korean woman. As though the brutal force and violence of the gang rape is not enough to drive the point home, only a few pages later, Cho, seething with anger and humiliation after hearing about this incident, in despair says, quote, Sapogot, the name of the village, is doomed. Unless the universe restarts, it's forever lost, unquote. So he goes on to tell another shameful incident. According to the story, a prostitute agreed to be hired by the American GIs to perform a sexual act with a dog raised on the army base and also to have the entire act videotaped. Coupled with the shock from the gang rape scene, Cho's telling of the story conveys an inexpressible shame and humiliation of not being able to fend off the debasement of the nation. The white soldiers are onlookers in the dehumanization of both Koreans and symbolized in the body of the women copulating with an animal and of the black soldier who willingly joins in this dehumanizing perverted sexual act. As one critic notes, Myung-hee, Ha rather sternly asserts, these very scenes may be interpreted as showing, quote, the predatory act of rape of the people that confirms the power of America as the conqueror occupying Korea, unquote. And also, quote, the neo-colonial process of invasion and subordination under U.S. occupation under the guise of protection, unquote. While I can concede to her point, I would like to take issue with this rather unequivocally political reading of reducing horrific and undeniably pornographic and even arguably masochistic scenes into a neatly packaged political message. This interpretive move typically evades the explanation of extremely uncomfortable and discomforting scenes. Moreover, it's nearly impossible to overlook the fact that the aggressors are, quote, raised, unquote, called in the derogatory names gamdungi, and that the bestiality scene becomes more repulsive as a black character, not white, happily joins the sexually deviant act and dehumanizes himself in front of the mad, perverted audience. So one of my main points is that so many Korean critics who talk about these military campdown literature as criticizing U.S. imperialism, I haven't seen anybody who actually talked about race. The fact that all of these figures are black characters in the novel, which is really strange. So that was really problematic for me. So I think that the deviance of the bestial menage a trois among the dog, the prostitute, and the black soldier is so utterly repulsive that it manages to debase and dehumanize the Korean women and the black soldier in an unprecedented way. The text also emphasizes that the dog retains more humanity than the women, but what is singularly odd about this scene is that the black soldier, who is not even forced into this degrading act, stoops to the level of the women or worse. What makes it troubling is that although the narrative frames the women and the dog to be captured on video, looked on and cheered on by the white soldiers, the narrative effect is such that the narrator of the story, Cho, who is actually the voyeur, who by retelling this tale, I mean, it was totally unnecessary for him to tell the story. And out of the blue, he just decides that he has to tell us. By retelling this tale conveyed to him by others, produces a masochistic pornography which is in the process of producing another pornography. So this is my reading. The patriarch who is unable to withhold the moral degradation of his land, as embodied in the trampled, sexualized bodies of Korean women, takes what can only be seen as masochistic pleasure in blaming himself for not being able to put it to stop. But at the same time, by putting the black soldier below the dog and the women, hierarchization of race takes place in an unusual way, As in the previous story, America, what immediately follows the scene is Cho's visit to a local prostitute to affirm his manhood after reminiscing about these episodes. To be sure, it's the same narrativization of the rehabilitation of Korean manhood patriarch in face of U.S. domination and emasculation. In this sense, despite the fact that many critics have praised that Gijichun literature plays the role of exposing U.S. domination and resistance against neocolonialism, the post-colonial subjectivity that emerges in these texts is deeply problematic at best and is deeply racist and masochistic in legitimizing white superiority, thus revealing a deeply entrenched colonial mentality and a deep sense of self-hatred. So I'm going to conclude today's talk by just reading a brief, just a few paragraphs of what I've been trying to argue today. So I've tried to show that the Gijichun stories of the 1950s and 1970s, up till the 1970s, appropriate blackness to mediate racialized post-colonial subjectivity of Koreans. While critics who adhere to nationalist paradigms see Gijichun literature as the citadel of nationalist resistance against the immorality of American GIs, critics of leftist tendency push this further and hail Gijichun literature as condemnation of neocolonialism. Feminist critics have also critiqued the nationalist and leftist scholars for overlooking the appropriation of the bodies of women and the erasure of their voices. My reading is not intended to supplant all of these readings in entirety, but to insist on a crucial part of these military camptown stories. The evident racism embedded in their representation of blackness as bestial, animalistic, and violent must be addressed in order to understand the post-colonial subjectivity emerging out of these neglected texts in Korean literature. Blatantly racist depictions of blacks as the violent and fearful other, and in some instances the trope of the black rapist, all point to the peculiar nature of racialized post-colonial subjectivity. The legitimization of white supremacy by representing blackness as inferior and the hierarchization of race reflect the perpetuation of the colonized mind. In this way, I try to suggest that the Gijichun stories may be read as demonstrating a powerful resistance against the socio-political subordination of Korea by the U.S., but nonetheless reflect the psychic colonization and the reconsolidation of racial ideologies. Only by facing this reflection in the strange encounter may the word post truly become liberating. Thank you.
This was really, a good presentation. In fact, excellent, and we learned a lot about Korea, post-colonial Korea, Korean literature. I'd like us to give a hand for our presenters here.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You have just heard a lecture by Dr. Ji Huan An from the Department of English Literature at the Seoul National University. Dr. An's lecture was titled Blackness and Postcoloniality in Korean Literature and Culture, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director Dr. Linda Haywood. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.